This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/BeHereNow.
Welcome to Conda Mason's Brown Rice Hour, a podcast that quilts together a fabric of connection between land, race, money, culture, and spirit. Discover a connection that engages with the most inspiring and cutting-edge thought leaders today, pointing toward our collective healing and liberation. If you are interested in supporting the Brown Rice Hour, please visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Conda.
All right, we are on. And so we are back. And my name is Conda Mason, and I am happily here to bring another edition of the Brown Rice Hour. And at the Brown Rice Hour, I have conversations with some pretty amazing people at the intersection of land, race, money, culture, and spirit. And so it could be a conversation in any one of those areas or a combination of the two or three or five. And so that's what we do here on the Brown Rice Hour. And today my guest is Larry Yang, who you'll get to know more about him, those of you who are not familiar with Larry. And I just want to first of all say thank you, Larry, for coming on the show.
Thank you for inviting me, Conda.
Yes.
It's a pleasure.
And so I always begin, Larry, with opening up a little bit of sacred space. And so I like to begin with land acknowledgement. I see you kind of have your land. Can you tell us where you're calling in from and a little bit of land acknowledgement?
I am on the Cahuilla land from the Agua Caliente tribe in Palm Springs, California, in Southern California. And I've been here full-time for about 2 years now.
Yeah. Oh, right. So Agua Caliente is the name of the actual tribe.
Correct.
Wow, I didn't realize that. Cool. I am calling in from the land of quite a few different tribes, the Chitimaca tribe, the Cushata tribe, and the Choctaw, as well as the Tunica Biloxi tribe. And the land now is called Louisiana, Alexandria, Louisiana, mm-hmm. is where I am calling in from. So just honoring the folks whose land we are settled on and have settled on. And that's an important part of opening up our sacred space by being honest about that, you know, and acknowledging and honoring that. And then also, I always like to honor Larry, our ancestors, and whose love and resiliency is how and why I'm here today. And the ancestors who have given so much to make this time possible for all of us. And so I like to honor your ancestors as well. Mm. And also, I look at the work that we are called to do now and giving thanks for the work that we are all called to do at this point in time. I think we're listening, hopefully, to the ancestors whispering in our ears and then those who come after us, right? That we may be good ancestors and leave a world that is better than the world that we received. And so all of that is in context to our time together. land, race, money, and spirit and culture. All right. So I'm going to introduce Larry right now. And he describes his work. When asked to describe your work, Larry, you said that the ever-changing journey to search for meaning and worthiness in this life. And I love that you said that. I thought, all right, we're going to get into that. We'll talk a little bit about that. And but let me first give a bio on Larry and who this man is. And then I also want to stress just how important Larry has been in my life. So much, so important to me. So he's a senior advisor in mindfulness and healing justice for the Katali Foundation, who provides grants to support community-based mindfulness and awareness practices for diverse multicultural communities and organizations. And for 20 years, Larry has taught meditation retreats nationally, has a special interest in creating access to both Buddhism and secular mindfulness to non-dominant cultures. And he has practiced meditation for 30 years, with extensive time in Burma and Thailand, and a 6-month period of ordination as a Buddhist monastic. Larry is one of the founding teachers of both East Bay Meditation Center in Oakland, which I am too a part of, and the Insight Community of the Desert in Palm Springs, where he is located at this moment, and was also on the Teachers Council of Spirit Rock Meditation Center for 10 years. And I have to say, one of the main teachers, one of the most incredible teachers there at Spirit Rock for many years. He's trained teachers for spiritual leadership within communities of color and the LGBTQI communities for 15 years. And Larry was honored for his work in racial justice by being selected as the community's choice for Grand Marshal in the 2016 San Francisco LGBTQI Pride Parade, whose theme that year was for racial and economic justice. Larry has written an incredible book called Awakening Together, The Spiritual Practice of Inclusivity and Community, that was published by Wisdom Publications. And his website is www.larryyang.org. He also says that in previous lives, Larry has been a national park ranger, which I did not know, a graphic designer, I knew that, a psychotherapist, public health social worker, and diversity consultant. So a little bit more about Larry is that I would have to say that my spiritual path that in the Theravada tradition and in mindfulness has been really guided by Larry. And had Larry not been who he is and was and has been in my life, I doubt if I'd be on this conversation right now. Honestly, Larry, you have been my teacher, my mentor, my friend, and has kicked me in the butt when I was taking too long to make decisions around my own path. Those phone calls, that would just, like, are you going to do this or not? You remember that, right?
Yes,
oh God,
of course.
I remember that. Like, and you have brought so many through the portal.
But you have to mention our astrological siblinghood.
Okay, that's right. So then astrologically, Larry and I are born like a few hours apart.
Correct.
Larry is a few hours older than me, so he's the elder, but we were born the same, just about the same day, a few hours apart, the same year. And that's February 27th and February 28th. So yeah, so there's that connection as well. So Larry, before we get into all the stuff that I really want to talk about, I want to talk about this too. I always start my this broadcast asking a question that that to me gets to a lot of different places within somebody. It's a simple question. And I am a big foodie, for one thing. Okay. And Brown Rice Hour is named Brown Rice Hour for a reason. It's an important aspect of my life, the brown rice and the role it has played in my life as I changed my diet and became microbiotic and all those kinds of things. And so I'm always curious about food. And so my question to you to begin with is, what was the food or the dish or something that you ate as a child that was your comfort food, and who prepared it?
Well, of course, my mother prepared it. And I will start with a preparer first, because my mother, even though she graduated from high school, even though she didn't go through it in, because she was taken out of it for a number of months or years, but she did complete it. But she didn't have any formal degree after that. She should have been a chemist, because whenever we went to a restaurant, it didn't matter if it was a Chinese restaurant, an American restaurant, a California cuisine restaurant. I would always rag her by saying, "Mom, stop playing with your food." And she would look at me and she would say, "Do you want this at home or not?" And sure enough, whether it was fried chicken, coq au vin, or chou fly pie, or anything, she would be able to replicate it over several iterations. But she would be able to figure out how to create that dish. And so there's a lot of comfort in her food rather than a specific
comfort food.
Mm-hmm. Recipe. Mm-hmm. And I went into this a little bit in another conversation that, and I think this is common, not, I don't want to generalize, but certainly it was in my family that culturally, it's not necessarily what you said. So the traditional parental guidance of always offering love to your kids and I love you and unconditionally, they tried, but that is not what they did in terms of their parental skills. What they did was they showed us how they loved us. Mm-hmm. It was the behavior. It was always creating that dinner table covered with things you could not eat. You know, that you just dove into the dinner table, and that was the experience of family.
Wow.
And that took a lot of effort. It took a lot of effort.
And it was just the different Chinese dishes primarily. Is that the cuisine?
She made the best fried chicken I have ever tasted.
Wow. Wow.
And her chili, I seem to have this memory. I can't validate it anymore because she's no longer here, but I think she put coffee in her chili.
Ground up coffee?
Yes, and it was delicious.
Wait, why do you think that? It tasted like coffee?
I just seem to remember, and maybe this is my own mythology, but she liked her chili hot because, you know, red pepper is a big thing in Asian cooking, and somehow the coffee cut it, but didn't interfere with, you know, I don't know. I don't have that particular recipe, but anyway.
Oh my God. So she was quite the cook. Speaking of food.
That means there's creativity, of course, in the dish.
So. Yeah. Wow. And where did you grow up with your parents?
I grew up outside of Philadelphia in one of those Levittowns. The folk singer Pete Seeger used to write about the ticky-tacky boxes of the emerging post-World War II suburban developments. And they are actually beautiful places to live for now, but back then it was sort of lower income, easily replicated homes. And they arrived in Philadelphia, and the reason that they lived there is because nobody would rent or sell to them in Philadelphia because they were an Asian immigrant family. So they had to go outside of Philadelphia. And,
wow.
And so,
and you were first born, first generation born in this country?
Yes.
In your family. And so, so your parents, since we're talking about this a little bit more, I'd like to, like, as immigrants coming over, what was that experience like? And I'm really curious if, you know, looking at the immigrant experience today in America, like how it compares, but what do you know about that experience that they had?
Well, gosh, you're going to go into territory that is so current for me and alive for me right now for so many reasons, including what's happening out in the world.
That's right.
Including the fact that my parents lived in Atlanta for 10 years. So my mom passed from COVID last August at the age of 104.
Yeah.
And I will say that, you know, I am semi-facetious in saying that it took a global pandemic to bring her down, because she was one strong force that supported her through this whole process of immigrating and developing more than just a life of survival, but a life that created something pretty amazing for all of us. So when she passed away, I was going through all my parents' paperwork because I didn't want to throw it away when she was alive.
And your dad had passed already, right? Your dad
about 10 years ago.
10 years
and,
ago.
And I found that being the obsessive parents who have raise this obsessive person speaking in front of you. They had collected all their paperwork from the quote unquote, the ticket on the slow boat from China, the freighter that she brought my brother on, the train ticket from San Francisco to Ohio, the letters of sponsorship that they got from anybody that they could connect with in the United States, from the YMCA, the student visas that my father had to go through when he was getting his graduate degree, through this piece of paper that was not even a full 8.5 by 11, that was from the State Department ordering their deportation in 1947 to Canada or their country of origin. Because this was happening all through the years of the World War II and the ending of the World War II, knowing that the Chinese Exclusion Act had not been dismantled yet. And all of the justification that he wrote after that order of deportation, and just realizing that what we're going through today is not, you know, it's just another manifestation.
That's right.
And that I also have all of the documentation leading up to the 1959 through the Joseph McCarthy era, of course, the letter of congratulations from the U.S. Congress in their naturalization and citizenship. And when I went through that, I breathed a sigh of relief because even though the oppression and the discrimination and the hatefulness in the larger culture is still there, that is the power of the immigrant experience, is to create a life that is independent of the suffering. And that my parents' story, even though I tell it a little bit dramatically because it impacts me directly. Their story is not unique. And it really inspires me to pass this on, you know, pass this level of support that I can still feel them at my back, even though they're gone. And I don't grieve that they're gone because what they created not only contributed to my well-being and my ability to do my life, but they contributed to this country and this culture.
Big time.
And, you know, a drop in the bucket. They did not pretend or want to be important people, but a drop in the bucket. How many drops in the bucket do we have in this world that can create this flood of, you know, both cleansing, healing, and just providing that foundation to go where our culture needs to go.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I'm looking at thinking about all of the horrible, horrible anti-Asian violence that's happening right now. That is just, it's so painful. It's so painful. And as a Black woman in America, it's like, I can't stand it. And I'm wondering, first of all, your mom passed away before seeing and understanding any of this, that this was happening. Not that it hasn't happened all along. So what do you think of when you think about the violence, the anti-Asian sentiment and violence that's happening right now? How does that impact you? And how do you see it on a trajectory of being here in America?
I will riff a little bit. There's a lot to say, and I'll riff both macro and maybe micro. So this history that I've learned or internalized from my parents' documents has given me the sense that history itself is a mindfulness practice. And history itself is a healing practice. If we can learn from it, that history is a receptacle of resilience. Just knowing how resilient my parents are allows me access to coming back over and over again and not going into that hole of despair, which is so seductive in the moment, and to look at the larger whole. So, you know, and so when I look at that history in beyond my family, and I realize that part of the Chinese Exclusion Act was not just excluding the first Exclusion Act around the Page Act was to prevent any immigration of Chinese women during the years of the railroad construction. And so, and also to prevent Chinese men from interracially marrying with Caucasians.
Right.
So it was a planned extinction, so to speak.
Right.
Except the intermarriage and the intermingling of Chinese and African American communities and couples, and that is what allowed the Asian experience to continue in the U.S. And I remember in the early days of the 1960s movements how much in solidarity. Each of the affinity groups, each of the cultural aspects were. And it is in the nature of white supremacy and white-centered, you know, culture to fragment.
To separate. That's right.
And this is what we have to learn over and over again.
That's right. That's right. I remember when thinking about like the ethnic studies department, it was the ethnic studies departments in the 60s, where it was the Asian American, the Latino, Latinx, and Black, all coming together to create and fight for ethnic studies department. And there was so much of that togetherness. And yet, like you said, supremacy, white supremacy is built on the concept of separation.
And, you know, the aspect of divide and,
that's
you
right.
know, being able to control.
That's right.
I try to internalize that learning when I forget. And that is the mindfulness practice, because you forget. And you get distracted, let's put it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think also what mindfulness and the practice of concentration helps us in this regard is to always remember what's important, what's in front of us, and that how do we keep our energies together rather than going into our separate. And there are many reasons to gain safety and to gain momentum and to gain resilience by going into our most familiar, safe communities. But there is also a reason to stretch beyond them, to keep stretching beyond them over and over again, to look at the larger picture of what is really causing the fragmentation.
Yeah. You know, you have a way, Larry, of bringing things back to mindfulness in such a, because it is the world. I mean, you, my lens that I get from you is that there's almost no place that mindfulness isn't, depending on your lens. And so I want to ask you about mindfulness and how, your journey getting there. How did you become, what brought you into mindfulness? What was your journey?
I'm not exactly sure the words I used when you were opening my introduction about searching for a path, a journey,
right. Right.
But I have always been curious about this life, and often I didn't have enough information to even know what I was curious about. So, you know, when someone first called me a racial epithet in elementary school, I didn't know what that was about, but I knew something was off. Something was not something was not healthy. And I got curious, well, what is that? You know, like, and my mother, when I asked her, what does the word chink mean? And, you know, I could see the look on her face, and she was so pained that I thought I did something to hurt her. I didn't know enough. But I still was curious, like, what is this? So there was some ability not to get lost in the pain itself. And so I just kept being curious. Okay, what is keeping me here? What is, you know, I'm feeling very different, especially as a gay young boy who didn't know what gay or homosexual or even any of those terms meant.
Right.
I just had different feelings. But what were those feelings as I was growing up, and what would allow me to relax into who I was. I kept asking myself, because none of the traditional answers of going into the sciences or becoming, you know, a lawyer or going to an Ivy League school really landed for me. It just caused me more angst because I couldn't do it. I went through, I don't know, 8 different majors in the first 2 years of my college because I kept flunking out, you know, because I wasn't interested until I found the fine arts and I could explore that. So, but then I, hindsight, and this took me years of therapy to figure out, is I used that art because I was feeling so oppressed as a gay man of color. And I was really good at creating aesthetics, which is part and parcel of being a gay man, but still.
Let's not get stereotypical. But.
Okay. I was going to define the environment around you. I was going to create, because I felt so controlled.
Right.
I was going to create the space that the dominant culture walked through, and they were going to like it.
Wow. Interesting.
That was the psychological. I didn't even realize that this was happening because it didn't work.
It didn't work.
I mean, you know, I could be pretty good at what I did, but it was number one, fleeting, and also, you know, the control that I was seeking to impose was in my mind. It was a fantasy,
right?
And so, you know, I became really good at looking good at the outside and feeling horrible on the inside. And so that dissonance, you know, created the conditions for a lot of substance abuse and despair you know, when I went into recovery was when I deconstructed everything. And that's when I started to look at, you know, why do you want to make things look good? And, so it does come from this cultural, you know, experience that's so deeply embedded in terms of the self-worth. And then the curiosity came back, you know.
And like, how old were you at this point in time?
This was, I was approaching 30 because, And in order to calm this crazy mind that thought I could control the world by designing, you know, the walls around you, I began meditating in order to create some space.
And how did that happen? Did somebody come into your life was a meditator?
In the 12-step program, there is the, you know, the step of spiritual.
Through the 12-step.
Yes.
Yep. Gotcha.
But, you know, my spiritual experience was nothing. And, you know, my parents went to the American Baptist Church in order to assimilate, you know, into their Levittown. And I had the chutzpah, so to speak, to... when the pastor asked me whether I wanted to be baptized when I was 13 or 14, I said no, because I didn't have a resonance with the community. And so when I stopped going to the Baptist church, my parents did too. And I began to realize, oh, they were going for me.
Oh, interesting.
So... Yeah. So I began to realize the cultural dissonance of this immigrant family. And even though my parents wanted me to assimilate, they felt that assimilation was success, a definition of success, of course. When I began to create space and the mind began to settle, I also found that I couldn't meditate very well. partially because the meditation centers were just the reflection of most of my life being white spaces, spaces that impose certain, mm-hmm. you know, rules mm-hmm. or so I actually learned in the beginning through books and, you know, the experimentation from your own experience that we often give as instructions, that's what I lived through.
Interesting. So it wasn't Sangha.
Not until there was one particular event that changed it, and that was an LGBTIQ retreat that happened in 1994. And I don't feel that I was seen completely as a person, but a portion of me.
A part of you.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And that was really important because one of the things that it showed me is that life did not have to be perfect. You don't have to be completely seen. But can you be seen enough?
Yeah, enough.
To be right. interested.
Right, right. To have belonging of some sort.
Enough.
Yeah.
So that I can walk through that door.
Right.
And then, I'll go into the micro story of, you know, my mother being at a assisted living facility in Rancho Mirage in the dining room. She's 102. And there's a woman who's also in some form of stage of dementia. And day after day, she will not sit with my mother.
Wow.
And educated.
This is a white woman.
White woman. Mm-hmm. Educated. Mm-hmm. And my mother was still aware enough to notice. And
at 102, it's yes. still going on. Uh-huh.
And yet, in the midst of it, number one, I was there, but also the staff was wonderful. Good. You know, what is good enough
yeah.
to allow her yeah. to tolerate?
Yeah.
You know, what is going to be around for a very long time?
Yeah.
And not be distracted by what is most important. And in front of her, it was, you know, her own sense of well-being at that time. She couldn't really,
yeah,
you know,
interesting.
But not to dwell too much on sort of pouring gasoline on the fire of other people's problems.
Yeah. Well, you know, so, this is interesting, Larry, to hear you. I mean, we've known each other a long time and it feels like this so much connecting of dots are happening for me right now about you. And I'm thinking about how important it has been for you to create the opportunity for folks, BIPOC folks, for LGBTQI BIPOC folks to enter this realm of mindfulness of the Dharma to impact their lives and then see where it takes them. You have been the biggest champion of anybody that I know, of opening the door and all that you have gone through to open up the door, open up the door, open up the door. And I'm hearing your own life as coming from the immigrant family, coming from everything that you're saying right now, that gap you said, you know, that gap of the exterior and then the interior suffering and all of that. And I'm just connecting dots of why this is so important to you. Let me know if I'm on the right track. I mean, has it been so important to you? Because it is. This is what you do.
It is what I do. And I don't know if it's, I don't want to place that word importance on it.
And so
I'll describe it differently.
Okay.
So, you know, I'm just curious about what would it take? And I'm going to go where you just went, but I'm going to,
okay. Yeah, sure.
You know, what would it take for the door to be more open than the one that I went through?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what would have to change other than, you know, the large systemic, you know,
right.
A cultural change, which we do impact, but slowly. But what around me can I influence to not just open the door, but to reconstruct the architecture, which is what my art background is,
mm-hmm.
is
mm-hmm.
how do you reconstruct the building so it has mm-hmm. no doors?
Mm-hmm.
And so as I practiced, as I began to practice, you know, more deeply and after that queer retreat, and luckily we both have known and worked with Marlene Jones, who really was the pioneer in many ways of creating BIPOC POC events in the Bay Area. Landed in the Diversity Council at Spirit Rock through her encouragement. And seeing the difference, feeling the difference between the BIPOC affinity spaces mm-hmm. and the mainstream spaces, I was practicing them concurrently
mm-hmm.
to explore, okay, so there is a huge difference here. What is that difference?
Yeah.
And what can be learned from both?
Mm-hmm.
And as I sat, it was the 2 month retreat, the first 2 month retreat that Spirit Rock did in, I think it was in the year 2000. During that retreat, I kept thinking to myself, and it was a question. There was no resentment that I remember from the question, but because I was the only person of the color and I was clearly sitting, Robert Hall, who has since passed away, has even mentioned this to me, that he remembers me because I sat in the back of the hall because I felt so different from the rest of the hall.
Yeah.
And I was it was the one thing that the teachers from the front could notice is that I was sitting so far away.
Right.
And I kept thinking, was not how far I was sitting away, but I was asking the question, what would it take to get a person like me up there? What would it take for the teachers to look or feel or behave in ways that I could relate to more
mm-hmm,
clearly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And
where your experience could be included.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And, mm-hmm. and that the stories, which we know are powerful instruments
right.
of change.
Yes.
I don't have to do an internal translation.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. You know, it's interesting because I remember, Larry, we were sitting, both of us were at Spirit Rock early, early on. We were sitting in the back of the room. I can't remember what it was. I can't remember what retreat it was. And I remember you saying to me, you had decided to go to Southeast Asia and you were going to go and robe and do the whole monk thing. And I turned to you and I thought, wow, you're really taking this stuff seriously. And I didn't know where it was for me, you know, but we were there at Spirit Rock and you had made that decision. And so now I'm curious when I think about, okay, you as born in the US, immigrant family, Asian culture, learning the Dharma from the convert Buddhist perspective, then going to Southeast Asia, entrenched in the real culture, I'm wondering how many parts of you, was that more congruent Did it show the kinds of distances you had and all the different many parts of you to be in the Asian culture, deepening in something that you had learned from convert Buddhism in the U.S. and being Asian yourself? I'm just curious about what that mix must have been like for you.
It's, you know, I think that was the product of my increasing awareness of how complex the cultural experience is for all of us.
Yes.
Not just my particular story, but I was working with the ingredients of my life, and I was realizing, oh, you know, I'm not my parents. They assimilated so much into dominant culture that they gave up all. My mother didn't even believe in acupuncture by the time, you know, she fully assimilated. That's what she had to give up.
Wow.
So I'm not there, but I'm also not with the Western sanitized interpretation that has been also colonized to be selective about what teachings to bring and what teachings not to bring from the cultures of origin of the Dharma. And that's right. What happens with colonial aspects on anything,
right.
Whether it's religion, science, art, whatever. So I did want to go back to the cultures of origin of the tradition and reconnect and see and be curious about, well, what hasn't been shared with us in this continent?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's not so much, you know, the academic spiritual texts,
mm-hmm.
Even though, you know, they are translated by primarily white scholars. It is the lived experience of having a monastery every half block, you know, having a temple every half block, having the practice be permeated into a culture, mm-hmm. as opposed to a practice that you retreat to outside of your life.
Right.
And noticing how the Western, many Western interpretations of the Dharma place diminutive judgments on what Asian practice is. That, oh, well, that's not really the true practice, or that's not the deeper practice, that's the community practice, as opposed to what the Buddha really meant, which is, you know, the deep meditative states in solitude or in isolation.
Right.
And really trying to explore, so what is the both and? How do you hold multiple truths together without putting them in hierarchical, you know, relationship or... And what would it be like? Again, going back to that question, what would it be like to have the Dharma offered through these different perspectives? And so I never really, you know, just going back a little bit to that 2-month retreat, I never really set out to be a teacher, a Dharma teacher. Or a meditation teacher. I was just curious, what would it take for me to learn from a different set of people? So that's that issue is not a personal issue to me. That is a collective issue. How do you create the collective conditions? And nobody could tell me. And so I just thought, okay, if nobody could tell me how to get, you know, that change just simply on the front dais,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Let's see if we can try to do it. And, you know, what does it take? If nobody can tell me how to do it, Let's find out.
Let's figure it out ourselves, huh?
And that's been, that was my path for a while.
So it's this curiosity. So I see why you took the word importance off and said that let's reframe it.
It's just, and it wasn't just me. It was, there were a lot of people that had the same vision, and just taking one step at a time and, cascading to a tipping point, and my experience in Asia was included in that because, I really saw a different cultural perspective on mindfulness and Dharma. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And realize that the Dharma can be very pure and very cultural at the same time.
Hmm.
And that, the sanitized purity that sometimes is discussed is really the Western cultural and that's
right.
as legitimate as
right.
another interpretation.
Right.
And that there are benefits of the Western conditions that actually can manifest the Dharma even further. For example, we have the ability to really marry justice and the dismantling of patriarchy, which is very much tied into Asian cultures of origin and the misogyny and bringing in the intersectionality of our identities.
Right.
That is, I think, one of the exciting places that mindfulness and the Dharma can go from where we are in this Western culture. Over the last two decades, the drops in the bucket have created this tipping point. And, there are more diverse, especially BIPOC spiritual leaders and teachers than ever before.
That's true. And you're being, I think you're being really modest. And yes, there's a lot of people and there's a lot of reasons why. And I have to say that, Larry, what you have created, like I started by saying, your impact in me and how I'm sitting here because of that, because of you. Also, Marlene Jones, of course. And that what I want to let folks know is that I and 19 others just have graduated from a teacher training, a Dharma teacher training from Spirit Rock that Larry and Gina Sharp and Leela Wheeler pulled together to train 20 out of 20 or 19 of us were BIPOC and our 18 of us were BIPOC. And these teachers are now, we're all out in the world. We've been teaching for a while, but because of that, another group on the other side of the country was also developed with another 20 some teachers. And so what I have to say is that your vision and your curiosity to answer that question, what would it be like, has led to this swell, this drop, starting with going back to East Bay Meditation Center. East Bay Meditation Center kind of creating out of the Spirit Rock, what would it be like if we had our own center that was in the East Bay, close to the ground of the people, by the people, for the people, anyone can come. You were instrumental in making that happen as well. So I just want to say that, your curiosity of that question has so positively impacted so many of us. And
I think if I can interrupt you,
sure.
I think that question has helped me not burn out.
Mm.
Because because I have been in the place, especially as a activist or a social worker or a community organizer, of really wanting an outcome. Mm-hmm. And when that doesn't happen based on, you know, like what we can see in American politics, you keep, you know, smashing your head into the brick wall.
Yeah.
And the question itself is like a river, you know, rushing over rocks, that it has its power. It may not be immediate, but what would it be like? What inspires me, and what would it be like to take a step in that direction? I have had the privilege. That's why I have so many like different, you know, like, I don't know, job things in my CV that I've had the privilege of just following my curiosity and following. And when that curiosity ends, that's when I am no longer meant to be doing that particular activity.
Yeah.
And, you know, the universe has taken care of me because my interests have supported me. And I think partially it's because my interest has not been about me. It has been about what can support us. And by supporting us, I support me.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that I think about often, and this is where my father is with me all the time, because he was a teacher in a classic Asian subject of electrical engineering that his students 40 years later would still be in touch and send him Christmas presents or whatever. So, and he always said to me, and I never felt this until my adulthood, that the measure of a good teacher, a great teacher, is how much their students supersede the teacher. And I have come to really appreciate his ability to be humble and yet continually to do things in what he believes.
That's a high bar for all of us.
And
high bar for all of us to supersede where you have gone, the Dharma lives in you. That's a really high bar.
That is the bar that will propel us to the next seven generations.
Right.
Whew. You know, the teacher cannot be the glass ceiling.
Right, right.
And I have so much energy and joy and ebullience that all of you will create a better world. And, you know, that's what keeps me going.
It's so interesting.
And that's why I'm working even more than I used to.
Because I know. You're supposed to be retired, right?
I know.
It's like you're at this point, at this moment, you are a retired Dharma teacher, but not really. You know, I think about all of us who have come through the Dharma door that you have so beautifully opened. And I can only hope, and there's such a variety of it's like a bouquet of different flowers. Everybody's doing what they do in different ways. It's really so wonderful to watch us, actually. And but it is a high bar. And we all just honor you so much, Larry. And I know that's not the point, but that is what happens when you have a teacher that you really love and respect that's been so profoundly impactful. You honor them. And you are so honored by us and by so many others. And so I just want to say that I'm grateful, deeply, deeply grateful to be a part of of a movement, because it feels to me like this is a movement, to be a part of a movement of BIPOC teachers in the Dharma who are impacting the world in so many different ways, and that have come out of this small door. Really, it started at Spirit Rock, that then has spread to the different places that it has, and to be a part of your world and what you have given to the Dharma. I'm just so blessed to be a part of that, and I do feel that we have a big. We have a big picture. We have a huge rock to roll up a hill still. And I see people doing it. I do see us doing it. And you have given, and you and Gina Sharp and Leela and all the other teachers have really given us the tools. You've given us the tools. And I'm just really, really grateful for that. And I want to ask you one last question, and this is kind of off on topic, but I'm curious, as I started, we talked about that you are now, one of the things that you have done in your retirement is that you work with the Kutali Foundation. And I'm so curious how working in philanthropy in that foundation intersects with the Dharma. If you can explain that, and how does it work for you? How is that? How did you say yes to that? That it works for your own curiosity. How does that work? Working there at Kutali Foundation.
On an energetic level, you know, as I was winding down my involvement in Dharma communities, I was clearing the table. And I was clearing the table not to know what I was going to do next, because, you know, I wasn't going to be immobile or passive in this life, but I didn't have a clear idea of I need to do this. And I was looking for something to be interested in. Mm-hmm. And this is how the cycles seem to have arisen and have closure in my life. When there's an ending of a cycle, like the teacher training and what you were referring to, as opposed to holding on to it. Mm-hmm. And letting go is not easy. Letting go means letting go of pleasant experiences, and we know that authority and power and the ability to do something is pleasant. As I cleared the table, this opportunity with a new grant making organization, Kutali, that was formed just in the last 2 years, really, and had a program area around mindfulness and healing justice specifically directed towards diverse BIPOC communities. And so on paper, it just felt like a good fit. But more important than that, more important than even the articulation of the vision, was the people involved, the values that were part of this emerging organization were clearly not just well thought out in terms of intellectual, but that these people had lived that experience for a while in order to bring the values into this new organization. Mm-hmm. And that, as opposed, and many of the folks who are social activists, including you, know what it's like to push, to stretch the envelope, to advocate, to have a more neutral word, to challenge, to speak truth to power, mm-hmm. to do all of those things. What is it like in the abundance of not having to do that, because it's already been done for you? that is what was stunning to me.
Yeah.
That power was humble. Therefore, it was easy to speak to. That our thoughts together were not just well received, but they were intimately respected. That there was no second guessing of, well, what if XYZ?
Right, right. Almost unimaginable, Larry.
And that confidence, mm-hmm. that experiential confidence, mm-hmm. gives you faith.
Yeah.
That this is the right direction. And, you know, one example of this, this spaciousness as well as not having to advocate and yet having the needs met. One of the examples is that they created, without any advocacy, this fund to do a rapid response against the anti-Asian violence that's happening. Mm-hmm. And that it was presented to the program advisors to execute. But there was, it emerged out of an organic, of course.
Of course.
We're going to do this.
Yeah.
And so that development of faith in the both the view and the actions that create the transformation that is needed in this world. Mm-hmm. This is where I feel that it is part of my spiritual practice, but it is part of a very deep ethical and integrity practice that this organization is engendering. And and so we're meant to support not just transferring wealth, which is a typical goal of philanthropy, just and for many reasons, you know, to get a good tax deduction or to alleviate, you know, the guilt of disparity in wealth. It is not just transferring wealth in terms of resources. It is also meant to transfer what wealth means in this country, which is power.
Power.
And the ability to live exactly as we're meant to live. Mm. And not be imposed on or controlled or determined mm-hmm. by narrow, dominant cultural views or
yeah.
And that is something pretty special. And I hope it
special.
I hope it ripples and I
yeah.
hope it affects other philanthropic efforts.
Yeah. You all are leading the field right now, without a doubt. And I had the pleasure of having Amaka Agbo, who is the CEO on the Brown Rice Hour as well recently. And she is just phenomenal. And if you haven't seen that, those of you out there listening, if you haven't seen that episode, please do with Amaka Agbo, just brilliant, who is the CEO of Katali Foundation. And what you all are doing is, and in the mindfulness space, I mean, to mix the philanthropy and the mindfulness is just, I've never seen it before. I've never seen it done so ethically. I've never seen it done so brilliantly, like you said, so well thought out, so integrated, and really you're leading the curve. And I'm hoping that other organizations and foundations and family offices will follow and look at you all and in the leadership role that you're taking. You know, Larry, this has been wonderful to have this conversation with you. I am so grateful that you said yes to.
Oh, I was nervous. I was totally nervous.
I know. I was like, why are you nervous? We go back like, you know, hundreds of years, lifetimes even.
But so, I'll tell the audience, the reason I really said yes is because I get to talk to you so infrequently.
Oh, come on.
If I have to do it in public, I will.
All right. Touche. I got that. I got that. More conversation between us. And it doesn't have to be public.
Okay.
Larry, thank you so much for joining. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah,
this has
been a lot of fun. Thank you. You know, thank you for supporting all the work that I've done. Thank you for supporting me as a person and, you know, what I really experience from you, Khanda, is a lot of love. So that's what I thank you for.
Oh, well, thank you, Larry. That's so sweet. That's the kindest thing ever. Yeah. And that's what I feel from you as well. That's what you give to me and you have from day one. So this is good.
Good to see you.
Yeah. You take good care. I love you.
Love you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.